it, but Tyrannus continued over him. Every member of the Fulminata values your spiritual guidance and your knowledge of the chapter's creed. Every engagement we have fought has involved your presence on the front line, whether you have employed your oratory or fought in the melee itself. And I myself find no shame in admitting that I have need of you, Castor. I have been thrust into a position of command during the white heat of a fully active combat zone. It is a duty I have long prepared for, but that does not mean I am happy to simply discard you or the advice you have to offer. You are now the most senior member of this Brotherhood. None of those still fighting have held their current rank for as long as you have held yours. Regardless of my position as First Lieutenant or Acting Captain, you are as much a commander of the Fulminata now as I am. Castor didn't have an immediate response. He let Tyrannus continue. You place me in a difficult position. I do believe Polixis still lives, though what foul purpose would lead to the Xenos taking him alive, I can only guess. I do wish to see him rescued, both for your sake and for the sake of the Fulminata. We need him, and that will only become more apparent the longer we remain on the front lines. All that being said, allowing you to seek him out runs the risk of committing a basic Codex error, compounding pre-existing failure. This is the nature of command, Brother Lieutenant, Castor said. You will rarely find yourself with an easy decision. Savor them when they come. Brother Captain Demeter taught me the importance of finding peace with every new course, Tyrannus replied. Sound analysis followed by firm commitment to a decision is one of the core tenets of command. For that reason, I have concluded that you will not go to find Polixis. You will remain here with the Demi Company. Silence followed the lieutenant's words, interrupted only by the low moaning of the ash wind and the ruffle of Castor's vestments and scroll pieces. Tyrannus carried on. You are too valuable to risk in an operation that offers such little chance of success. Permitting you to leave would be a dereliction of my role as leader of the Fulminata. You will not go into Shebat Alpha seeking Helix. Instead, I will dispatch a Reaver team under Severus's command. They will seek his trail, and if possible extract him, dead or alive. They are ideally suited to this sort of mission. Their loss would scarcely be less of a blow to the company than my own, Castor said. That is correct, but I consider the likelihood of their return to be far greater. They are under orders to maintain their covert protocols at all times. They will be airdropped into the tombstones, and from there work their way into Shebat from the southwest over the next few days. If they cannot locate Polixis, or if they deem his extraction untenable, they will withdraw and return to us here. I see, Castor said, forcing his voice to remain level. I pray the Emperor has guided you to this decision, Brother Lieutenant. I will ask his blessings on both you and our Reaver brethren. My thanks, Brother Chaplain, Tyrannus said, inclining his helmeted head slightly. And my thanks also for your understanding. I will not be surprised if the Xenos return before nightfall, and when they do, I will have need of you more than ever before. I will visit the squads once more, Castor said, and what guard regiments I can. No, Tyrannus said, the word catching Castor by surprise. You have given much these past few days, Brother Chaplain. I believe it would be best if you sought a moment of personal reflection. The Xenos will take some hours to build their strength once more, and I have seen to the rest of the Fulminata. Go and quieten your mind. We will have need of you soon enough. Very well, Brother Lieutenant, Castor said. Though the urge to continue walking the line and venting his anger was strong, he realized the lieutenant's suggestion was a good one. He needed peace, if only for a while. Tyrannus dismissed him, and he passed out towards the rear of the Imperial lines. It felt strange to be suddenly alone, after the cramped environment of redoubts and bulwarks, flak boards and sandbags. The ash wastes stretched away from him, flat desolation interspersed with thickly coated boulders and wiry, grey-caked rot roots. He pressed on into it, his boots sinking heavily into the soft, shifting soil. The targeting matrices of his visor bounced across his display, seeking hostile contacts, seeking anything at all that it could lock onto. The only interesting thing it found to highlight was Castor's destination, the smoking wreckage of an orc aircraft, brought down the night before and left burning out in the wastes. It had ploughed a long furrow when it had crashed. Both its wings were gone, and its tail section had come away, buried in the grey soil 100 yards away. What remained of the fuselage lay at the end of its destructive ditch, burned out, smoke still coiling from its half-buried nose grill. Castor circled the mangled cockpit. He found 3 bodies within, charred and blackened beyond recognition, the skeletal fists of one still clamped around the aircraft's flight stick. He mounted the fuselage, the metal groaning under his weight. Once atop it, he sat, his legs folded, the wind tugging at his vestments. Once seated, he reached down and pulled his copy of the Lectato Ultramar onto his lap, along with its iron key. Both hung from the heavy consecrated chains wrapped around his waist, fastened there, even in the heat of battle. The Lectato itself was a mighty tome, its covers protected by a layer of flak plate stitched into the red leather, its pages bound by an ornate plasteel lock clamp. An ordinary human would have struggled to even lift it, but Castor could carry it easily enough in the crook of one elbow, and had long grown accustomed to its unwieldy bulk, whether in or out of combat. It had broken the skulls of a number of heretics and Xenos in the 6 decades since he had finished inscribing and binding it. He slotted the key in and unlocked the cover clamp, opening the weighty vellum pages to the place marked by a black strip of velvet. It felt like an age since he had consulted the book. He found himself missing the dark, weighty stillness of the chapel of the Dioscuri. It was the place of worship he tended to aboard the Spear of Macragg, and it remained the closest thing to home he had left in the galaxy. He banished such thoughts, silently chiding himself for his weakness. Sentimentality was a sin, at times a grievous one. It dulled the honed blade and softened minds that were required to remain forever battle-keen. It had no place in the hearts of a Primaris. He looked down at the last passage he had marked, one digit following the words, as it had done ever since his days as a notary. It was a sermon from the 12 Nights of Absolution by Past Master Antonio Polaris. The short homily stressed the importance of the acceptance of failure and the need for salvation, the acceptance that none were perfect in the Emperor's sight, and none could truly live up to the tenets of the Codex without spot or blemish. Acceptance did not mean that a warrior of the chapter acknowledged any lesser effort, but it guarded against the multitude of heresies that could stem from the frustration that so often haunted brothers of the Adeptus Astartes. Anger, confusion, and bitterness all reared their ugly heads when a Jenhunt's champion accustomed to victory suffered a severe or sudden setback. Accommodating failure was one of the hardest lessons, especially for a Primaris. Castor pondered the words, confronting his own failures since his arrival on Ikara. The loss of first Captain Demeter, and then Polixis, and his own inability to help either of them. He exposed the white heat of his rage and disappointment, and allowed it to cool. Attaining detachment, removing himself from the present, and analyzing his own thoughts and actions, were skills that had always come more naturally to Polixis. Castor envied him that. His own mind only seemed to function in the present, driven on by instinct and reflex. He found it easy enough to offer up advice on the trials of others, but when it came to his own difficulties, he so often found himself enslaved to his passions. He finished the passage, uttering the short catechism that closed Polaris's teachings. The next page offered a tactical sermon on Codex Standard Protocols for a battalion to division-level combat withdrawal, summarizing the salient aspects with a series of skull-headed bullet points. He read over the long memorized words without really focusing, his mind still on the previous passage and on the book as a whole. "Thank you for the instruments of your will," he murmured as he read, drawing a slow, steady reassurance from the heavy tome. At times, a warrior was guilty of only venerating his arms and armor. The Lectato was proof that a true servant of the Emperor required more. The book itself was one of half a dozen texts held in reverence by the Ultramarines. It had been the magnum opus of Master of Sanctity Balthazar Quillex, arguably the chapter's greatest spiritual leader of the 34th millennium. Using his vast knowledge and indomitable faith, he had set out to transcribe a condensed copy of what he believed to be the core tenets of the Codex Astartes. He had combined these with the foundational teachings of the chapter's reclusium to create the Lectato, a blend of the chapter's doctrine and faith. Of course, Quillex's undertaking had been controversial at the time, and remains so to the present day. Some believe the Codex, the sacred writings of their own blessed Primarch, could and should not be reduced or distilled in any way. There were others, however, who had always pointed out that the Codex itself frequently stressed adaptability and a suspicion of dogma. The view of the Codex and its teachings as more malleable had become increasingly commonplace since the return of the Great Gilliman. It was a view often associated with the chapter's Primaris contingent, and while both the Primarch and the likes of Chapter Master Marnius Kalgar had been clear in their demands for cooperation between the Hardliners and the Adoptionists, there had been a great deal of impassioned debate over the past few decades. Castor had always been a believer in Quillex's philosophy. That which was rigid, broke. That which bent, endured. He was living proof of that. He and every Primaris who now fought throughout the galaxy. The Imperium's dogmatic teachers would never have sanctioned his creation, would likely have destroyed his kind in their cryotanks if they had discovered them. But without the Primaris, and without the blessed Primarch's foresight, the Imperium would no longer exist. To adhere for dogma's sake alone was in itself a sin. Dogma was why the Imperium suffered now as it did. Castor knew that dogma demanded he obey Lieutenant Tyrannus. It demanded he stand with his brothers on the ridgeline and leave the salvation of his blood brother to Severus and the Reavers. "I do not serve dogma," he murmured to himself. "I serve the living Primarch and the living Emperor." The Fulminata would bend, but they would not break. Of that much he was certain. He knew each of his brothers. He had spoken to them in turn in the aftermath of the previous night's storm. They were vengeful and resolute. They did not need his guidance. What was more, they were being reinforced. The dust cloud to the south was testimony to the weight of the Astra Militarum forces moving up to the ridgeline from Croton. As much as Kloss would be struggling to admit it, Von Klimt was delivering on his promise to back up the ragged forces driven from Shibat, shifting the weight of Imperial efforts on Ikara to the new front. Within a week, the tenuous line along Ridge 1 would be the epicenter of sprawling defensive works 60 miles long. The Fulminata would be withdrawn and utilized in their traditional role whenever they found themselves deployed to a grinding war of attrition, as a mobile reserve used to stem breakthroughs or spearhead the counterattack when it eventually came. Such an operational stance had little need of Castor's oratory skills, at least in the short term. That was what he told himself as he turned to another passage. The losses of Captain Marcus Drado, a cautionary tale about the struggles of a former commander of the Second Company who had found his duties impeded by his desire to preserve lives. Ultimately, his decisions had only resulted in more death and misery among those he had sought to save. It served to teach the Adeptus Astartes the truth of their condition, that time and again they would be called upon to abandon those who looked to them for protection, or even worse, turn against them for the greater cause. Like all Space Marines, Castor knew the extent of the timeless evils that stalked humanity. Combating them required sacrifice, not the easy, honorable sacrifice made in the heat of battle for a brother in arms, but the desperate deeds that tried the soul. "Is that the sacrifice I'm being required to make now?" he asked aloud, the book still open before him. "Am I to be tried for hypocrisy, for espousing the necessity of loss among others, only to abandon everything to ease my own pain?" Was he truly going to disobey Tyrannus and leave behind the Fulminata on a mission that would almost certainly end with his own death? He realized that his hands had clenched into fists, resting on the Lectato's pages. The insidious ash had already covered them in a thin, dusty layer. Angrily, he swiped the residue away and closed the book, the clap of the heavy cover echoing out over the wasteland. There were no easy choices, but he had made his. He dropped down from the ruined aircraft's fuselage, boots thumping in the dust. In the distance, his auto-sensors picked out a familiar thudding sound, followed by a dull crump. More followed, a far-off staccato ripple. He recognized the report of artillery, greeting the oncoming evening. The afternoon was wearing thin. He would have to hurry. Checking that the Lectato and its key were chained securely around his waist, he began to jog back towards the distant ridgeline, servos whirring, thoughts ignited once more. Chapter 7. Doctor's Orders. Polixis. Why he still lived, Polixis did not know. They tried to knock him out as they dragged him to the foot of Ridge One's slope. They beat his helmet with cudgels and the flats of their cleavers, grunting furiously. Polixis endured each ringing blow, unable to resist. It was almost impossible to knock an Adeptus Astartes unconscious, and doubly so with a Primaris. His helmet held, though a crack had appeared over his right eye lens, splitting his visor. The display remained blank and inactive, his servos unresponsive. After a while, his captors gave up and hauled him up once more, six of them, struggling with his weight. They were all clad in the soiled camo capes and patchwork infiltration gear of the mob that had attacked him from behind in the redoubt. As they moved downhill and back towards Shebat, they forced their way through the warband still headed towards the battle raging across the ridgeline. Some greenskins tried to get at Polixis, roaring excitedly, but his captors beat them away with grunts and balled fists. They reached one of the rickety flatbed engines greenskins commonly use for transportation, parked a few hundred yards from the base of the slope, and protected from the greedy gaze of nearby mobs by several more of the cape-clad orcs. Polixis could do nothing but snarl with frustration as he was hoisted up into the truck's rear end, most of the mob clambering up after him. The vehicle's abused engine revved, and the tires bit ash and grit as they spun, sending the transport skewing in the direction of Shebat. Polixis was shifted to the left, but kept largely in place by the hobnailed boots of his captors. They were shouting over the throaty sound of the engine, partly with exhilaration at the breakneck ride, partly due to the nature of their prize. Why he had been spared, let alone snatched in what seemed to be a premeditated plan, Polixis had no idea. He could only assume he was going to be used as some sort of trophy, or perhaps enslaved, put to work in a gladiatorial pit. Intelligence claimed that the Xenos were running an expansive slave trade west of the Gorgon, mostly dealing in captured citizens and waste nomads, and supplemented by those Imperial guardsmen foolish enough to allow themselves to be taken alive. If the Xenos filth thought he would allow himself to be used in such a way, they would soon regret their mistake. He tried to move again, but still his armor wouldn't respond. His visor remained blank, and the servos inert. He spat a string of expletives that would have made Castor snarl a reprimand at him. The greenskins sensed his frustration. One of the brutes hanging onto the stanchion along the edge of the flatbed bellowed angrily over the excitement of its kindred, gesticulating at him. The one with the prong stepped unsteadily over the boots of the rest of the mob and lunged downwards. Polixis braced himself, teeth gritted, just in time for the surge of pain from the prong that arced through his body. It felt like a long time before the truck screeched to a stop. They'd left Ridge One behind, the thunder of battle fading away until it was consumed by the roar of the transport. The ride became more juddering as they reached Shabbat and began to careen across rubble-choked streets. Polixis was slammed back and forth in the foot of the flatbed, his armor scraping its sides. The greenskins kicked him at every opportunity and let out bestial laughs, even as they struggled to keep their own grip on the bouncing truck. At one point, as they surged over a heap of broken debris and all four wheels left the ground, one of the runtier greenskins slipped and tumbled out of the open rear end. The others just laughed all the harder, gesturing crudely as the unfortunate orc picked itself up from the rubble, receding rapidly into the distance.
"Emperor, give me strength," Polixis murmured to himself,
struggling once more against his unresponsive armor. In that moment, he wished that Custer were there, if only because he would know the right words to ease his fury. His struggles were impotent, and the Xenos knew it. The truck braked violently, throwing both Polixis and most of the orcs hard against the drive compartment. The engine cut out, whether killed on purpose or because it had finally broken from the strain, Polixis couldn't tell. All he could see was the low, grey Ikaran sky, paralyzed as he was. The greenskins started manhandling him once more, heaving him like so much dead weight out of the truck's back. He immediately recognized where they had taken him. The Basilica of St. Albarak the Smelter. The great Gothic structure still stood, looking sadly out over the ruination of the city that had built it. Polixis wondered whether it would have been better to have seen the place of worship reduced to rubble. The fact that the greenskins had claimed it seemed like a far worse fate. The square beyond its front steps was now choked with refuse, while the great Aquila doors had been broken open and cast down, the gold cladding bent out of shape and befouled by greenskin dung. Blood, paint, or both, had been used to daub crude glyphs across the basilica's stonework, and a ragged banner depicting a wicked, curved blade and a leering half-moon fluttered above the open entranceway. The sight of the basilica's defilement made Polixis's heart burn with a fresh surge of fury, far removed from the detached, forensic mindset he was accustomed to. It was his own impotence that did it, as much as the thought of alien filth defiling mankind's great works. He was a warrior, modified and then honed for nothing less than eternal war. To be rendered entirely unable to fight, to even resist, as he was dragged like a trophy corpse towards the basilica, enraged him beyond reason. The fact that it was his own armor, brutalized by Xenos cunning, that had left him incapacitated, only completed the irony.
"You will suffer for this," he shouted. "I will see you all slaughtered, like the animals you are."
The orcs around him mirrored the shout with crude grunts and bellows, mocking him as they heaved him in through the basilica's open doors. The inside was a scene of bedlam. Greenskins had infested the place of worship in its entirety. They had hung their ragged banners and skulled lifts from the balconies and buttresses, while others had smashed the carved rustwood pews to splinters and heaped the remains as kindling around the nave. More dung and indiscernible debris covered every surface, along with stacks of trash and rubble that seemed to have been dragged inside as loot. The greenskins themselves were everywhere. Orcs, Gretchen, and even the bulbous moor beasts called squigs, leashed on rusting chains, slavering and snapping at anything that got close. They argued and scrapped, ate rancid meat and drank foul brews across the nave and on the balconies, amidst the cloisters, and right to the back of the annexes. A place that had once resounded with the diligent praise of mankind's faithful, now echoed with the raging, raucous, manic madness of total alien supremacy. At its epicenter lay what had once been the basilica's apse. The semicircular space had been transformed into the throne dais of the beast that had come to conquer Ikara. Polixis was hauled towards it, and as he was taken down the nave, the noise of the greenskins intensified. They flocked to him from all sides, howling, their spit befouling his armor as he was moved by his captors to face the monstrosity that awaited him. It was seated upon a chair of stone, darkened by blood and filth and surrounded by what looked like piles of wreckage hidden beneath heavy squig skins and hides. It took several seconds for Polixis to realize the base of the throne was in fact the remains of the basilica's altar block. Crude metal spikes had been riveted into it to form a barbaric resting place. The outrage he felt at such blasphemy didn't last long. His eyes fixed on the creature that lounged atop it, the beast that rose as he was dragged onto its dais. As befitted all orc warlords, it was gigantic in size. Even though it was hunched, it towered over its surrounding attendants. Its incredible musculature and trunk-like body held neither surprise nor fear for Polixis. He had spent the past century killing beasts just like it. But there was something different about this one. That became apparent when the apothecary was finally thrown down before it. For a creature so high in the esteem of its kind, it wore relatively little in the way of armor or customized weaponry. Hide clothes and furs adorned it, and two long serrated blades hung from its hip, along with a collection of yellowing skulls. What really caught the ultramarine's attention, however, was the nature of its flesh. It did not take Polixis's extensive knowledge of anatomy to recognize that the thing he was looking at wasn't one creature, or at least it hadn't been originally. For a start, it was misshapen. An arm and a leg were shorter than their counterparts, giving it a lopsided stance, and the hunch of its back was even more pronounced than usual. One eye was notably larger and more dilated than the other, and its jaw jutted forward so much that thick wads of drool seemed to constantly dangle from its tusks. It might simply have been a particularly ugly Xenos, were it not for the evidence of the flesh itself. It was marked all over by savage, willful surgery. The thing was a mass of mismatched green flesh, crisscrossed with crude sutures and thick stitching. Deep surgery scars ran from the base of its skull down the center of its face, binding together the paler and darker halves of its skin. It wouldn't have taken an apothecary's eye to discern that the individual dermal patches were foreign to one another. The shades and textures varied massively. The thing that ruled the orcs on Ikara and the surrounding systems, the thing that called itself Warboss Urgork, was a freak of diabolic science and testimony to the unnatural hardiness of its race, taken to the nightmare extreme. It was a patchwork horror of sewn-together orc skins and body parts, and the very fact that it was alive and conscious sickened Polixis. The thing leered at him, a drooling, tusked grin, one of its mismatched yellow eyes blinking, while the other remained glazed. It gestured at the greenskin still holding him, and barked a string of commands, spittle spraying the apse's grime-smeared flagstones. They dragged him to one side, to where a rack of thick metal struts and coiled razor wire had been bolted to the floor. Again, Polixis tried to force action into his limbs, straining against the prison that his armor had become. He felt a few servos tick and grate, but beyond that, nothing. The orcs slammed him against the rack and dragged clamps and wire around his limbs, snaring him. Only then did the warlord approach. It did so with a pronounced limp, a hand fingering the hilt of one of its wicked blades, its leer replaced by the focused expression of a curious animal. It stopped a few paces from the bound Primaris, its minions flocking round, silence settling slowly across the riotous space.
"The White Beaky," Urgork rumbled.
He spoke in a hideous, stammering bastardization of Low Gothic, but it was intelligible. Polixis said nothing in reply.
"You's the boy I've been looking for," Urgork continued, moving a little closer. "The big beaky git I've heard all about. They tell stories about you lot, you know. You's the lad that patches them all up. My weird boy's seen it."
Polixis still refused to respond. Urgork pointed a claw at the sea of ugly green faces around them.
"These lads all came here to fight.
didn't you, boys?"
The orcs roared their agreement, the sound rebounding thunderously from the vaults high above. Amidst it, Urgork leaned closer, his voice lower.
"But I didn't. Sure, I wanted to scrap with the big new beakies, but I got something else on my mind too. You's gonna help me, git, and when you's done, I'll give you a good quick death. Won't even strip your skin."
The creature tapped one of his long blades. Polixis tried with all his might to move his limbs. His muscles clenched and strained, and his jaw locked. A slow hissing breath escaped from between his teeth as he focused everything into trying to wrench his arms free from their bonds. There was a low grating sound, the misery of locked servos being forced against their will. The barest hint of movement followed, as both arms inched forward slightly before coming up against the resistance of the clamps. Urgork looked at him with what could have passed for a quizzical expression, a wad of saliva drooling from between his tusks. He leaned close to the clamps, as Polixis struggled in silence, as though inspecting them, as though he hoped to see them bend and break beneath the fury of the Primaris. Instead, they held firm. The orc grunted and motioned to the mob surrounding them.
"Zap him again, Morglum!"
The smaller greenskin with the electro-prong pushed itself to the fore and plunged the crackling rod into Polixis's flank without hesitation, the bolts of lightning picking out its rictus grin. The apothecary's struggles ended, and a cry of agony was ripped from his throat as the powerful electrical charge surged through his body, channeled directly into his flesh by his dermal nodes.
"I like it when you big humies struggle,"
Urgork said over the crackling sound.
"But I also likes watching you fry as well. So why not have both?"
The charge cut off, bolts of lightning still arcing and sparking across Polixis's armor.
"You's a quiet one, ain't you?"
Urgork demanded.
"Don't go all shy on me, Beaky."
The warlord stepped close and placed one great hand on Polixis's helmet. Energy danced and snapped from the white ceramite and up the greenskin's stitch-crossed arm, but if the orc felt any pain, he didn't show it. He held Polixis's head in the palm of his great, scarred fist. Then, with sudden, savage motion, he reached up with his other hand and snatched the helmet between them. He locked fingers behind Polixis's head and started to pull. Ceramite and plasteel groaned. Polixis felt a hideous pressure on his neck and spine, and his breath caught. He knew that, ordinarily, such an assault on his battleplate would have caused warnings to burst to life across his visor display. But there was nothing. It remained blank. His auto-sensors were dead, and his servos locked. It would have been natural for a human mind to give in to panic or despair. An Adeptus Astartes was immune to the former, but the latter was not unknown. In that moment, Polixis realized that he was almost certainly going to die, if not in that moment, then very soon, and that he would likely do so in pain so excruciating that even his transhuman body would be unable to block it out. Far worse were the realizations that his blessed armor and equipment would fall into the grubby, defiling hands of the Xenos, and that his own progenoids would be left to rot with his corpse, abandoned and forgotten.
"Castor, give me strength," he said, from between gritted teeth.
He said it without thinking, intoning Castor's name as readily as the Primarch's or the Emperor's. He had always been there, always ready and willing, no matter the task. To be taken and used like this wasn't only bringing shame upon the chapter, it was bringing shame to Castor. Urgork gripped and twisted his helm all the harder. The plasteel's groan became a tortured shriek as the gorget finally broke and the seal was ripped open. Polixis let out a gasp as air flooded his lungs again, and the unbearable tension on his neck lessened. Even a space marine would certainly have had his head torn from his shoulders by the orc's brute strength. Only the incredible durability of Primaris physiology had saved him. He blinked as his eyes adjusted automatically, exposed now before the assembled aliens. Urgork dropped the helmet. It cracked from the flagstones before rolling down the steps from the apse, not even reaching the bottom before a bickering mass of Gretchen descended on it. Urgork leaned in close to Polixis, the orc's vile stench engulfing the ultramarine, wicked tusks and mismatched cruel eyes just inches away.
"Now we can look at each other, one pretty face to another," Urgork growled.
Polixis met the orc's gaze, but said nothing. His brother would probably have snarled a prayer of purging, or spat in his face, but the apothecary did not see the point in either action. He would not converse with Xenos. The warlord grunted, half turning away.
"Maybe this will get you interested. Grok!"
There was a scrabbling sound, and another greenskin wormed its way to the front of the assembly. It was a bent-over creature, clad in what Polixis realized was a hideous mockery of a human medicase uniform. A soiled white smock and black rubber gloves, complete with an optical cluster strapped to its bald head. The strange greenskin came up short when it latched eyes on Polixis, its jaw hanging slack.
"Told you I'd get one, didn't I?"
Urgork demanded. The runty creature nodded, not taking its own greedy eyes off Polixis. The apothecary recognized its expression, but it took long seconds for him to properly place it. It was staring at him in veneration. The orc was looking up at him the way so many humans had done before, with a heady mixture of awe and fear. The realization made his skin crawl. He found himself looking away, where moments before he had held the gaze of a beast perfectly capable of tearing his skull from his spine.
"You two good lads is gonna help each other,"
Urgul continued, clapping one hand on Polixis's pauldron and the other on the small orc's shoulder.
"You is gonna help each other to help me."
"I would rather die a thousand deaths," Polixis said, unable to hold his tongue any longer. "If you think I would even consider helping you, then you know nothing of my kind."
"I know a thing or two,"
Urgork said, grinning at the Primaris.
"We'll see if you still talking so tough after we is done with you."
"There is no torture that you could devise that would turn me against my own species."
"You boys is odd lads, no denying that,"
Urgork said, his stammering appearing to grow worse.
"I could put my skinning blades to work, and I could use my pain boy here and my weird boy. Maybe even old big mech cog crusher. And I reckon altogether we could cook something up that'd make you squeal eventually. Could take some time, though. Ain't no point either. Not when I's already got a better idea."
"It will do you no good," Polixis said. "The weight of Imperial retribution will be upon you soon."
Urgork laughed, a wet, ugly, hacking sound. The laugh gave way to a bout of coughing, and a sudden rigidity took hold of the greenskin's posture. A hand shot out, snatching for the hunchback medic as the warlord's distended jaw locked and his eyes widened. Foam began to bubble around his tusks. The thing called Grok stuffed a hand in the hide satchel it was carrying, and dragged out a wicked syringe filled with a foul-looking yellow liquid. Without pause, it slammed the needle into Urgork's flank and rammed down the plunger. The warlord spasmed, shuddered, and the surrounding orcs pushed and shoved against one another as they tried to back away. Polixis stared at the warlord in morbid fascination, automatically picking up on details without really registering them fully. The dilated eyes, the spasming movement, the muscular contractions and locked jaw. A low, keening sound escaped Urgork's throat, curiously at odds with his towering bulk. Then, abruptly, his head snapped to the side, and he spat a great wad of bilious phlegm at Polixus's feet.
"That's better!"
the warlord wheezed, bones and sinews popping and crunching as he flexed his arms and took a few deep, rattling breaths. He rounded on Polixus once more, and a feral madness blazed in his yellow gaze.
"Not seen one of the lads do that before, have you?"
he demanded, brutish expression caught somewhere between anger and amusement.
"But I can tell you's never met a boss like me, neither. I'm one of a kind, and you's gonna help me out whether you likes it or not."
Polixus said nothing, simply held the orc's mismatched glare. The greenskin grinned more broadly and gestured at him.
"Zap him again."
Castor. Castor left as evening drew near, and mankind went to war once more against the green menace. Orc artillery had been brought up and bedded down in large quantities along the edge of Shabbat, and as the shrouded sun began to dip towards the tombstone's sawtooth peaks, they started an indiscriminate bombardment of Ridge One. The Astra Militarum's big guns, which had until that moment remained silent to avoid triggering another massed assault, returned fire. According to Castor's visor display, 5th and 8th Corps were being fully stood to once more, as shellfire blossomed and great clods of ash and dirt showered down on newly repaired sandbag redoubts. The first large-scale reinforcements from Croton, a spearhead division of Moscatin Light Infantry, was arriving at Ridge One's rear echelons and receiving their deployment orders, bellowed to them over the hammer of Basilisk mobile artillery pieces and Griffin heavy mortars. Castor was only vaguely aware of it via the tactical updates logged on his visor. He departed with Task Force Marilis just before the light started to fail. The air war, dormant all day, was beginning to come alive once more. The Vox was reporting a mass daytime air raid on Croton, and Augur systems had picked up more waves bound for the skies above Ridge One. The day before, the Greenskins had focused their aircraft on one target and then the other. Today, it seemed as though they were using their vast numerical superiority to strike at both with simultaneous, equal force. Castor suspected there was nothing Flight Marshal Roggins could do but deploy a few token wings to contest them. One of those wings flew cover with the Thunderhawk Dromedas. Its pilot, Brother Quilo, took it hard and low for 60 miles south of Ridge One, arcing slowly westwards as they swung wide around Shebat Alpha's southernmost remains. The Thunderbolts sent to chaperone the Ultramarine's flyer stood off, maintaining an operational altitude ceiling in order to avoid drawing attention to their charge. As evening drew in, a flight of greenskin heavy bombers were spotted heading northwards. For a while, it looked as if their fighter support was going to sweep away from the raggedy formation and give chase. Whatever beast commanded the wing, however, clearly knew better than to allow its escorts to leave the bombers exposed. After a brief detour, the greenskin fighters rejoined their heavier cousins, and the Thunderbolts resumed their southwestward course, roaring far above the rattling Thunderhawk. Castor sat within Dromedus's hold, strapped to one of the restraint benches. His helmet was maglocked to his belt, revealing the features he shared so closely with his blood brother. The golden hair, firm jawline, and soft, discerning eyes. Those eyes were on the other occupants of the transport as it jutted through a fresh patch of turbulence. There were three of them, Primaris Ultramarines seated across from the chaplain. They wore the customized, form-fitting power armor and death's head masks of the Reavers, and their own bowed heads and silence mirrored that of the chaplain. Castor contemplated them without speaking, knowing they were all aware of his gaze. Severus himself sat opposite Castor, flanked by his two death brothers. Their names were Phobos and Strix. All three had removed their helms, though the skull masks remained in place, obscuring their lower faces. Not for the first time, the chaplain pondered the similarities between his own office and those who followed the path of the Reaver. Some called them a cult. It was a false accusation. Castor had examined the beliefs of each one of the Fulminata's death brethren in detail over many decades. Their actions and attitudes set them apart. Castor could understand how their fellow Ultramarines, especially non-Primaris, found them a strange and potentially dangerous addition to the chapter. They were taciturn in the extreme, and when they did interact with their battle brothers, they usually displayed either a high degree of morbidity or a vicious, bloodthirsty streak that seemed far removed from the balance espoused by the Codex. Their mode of warfare required them to be ruthless, efficient, and when necessary, uncompromisingly brutal. Such attributes were far from uncommon among the Adeptus Astartes, but among the Reavers they were amplified, sharpened to an edge as wicked as the long blades they wielded with such chilling ability. Severus exemplified them, taciturn at best, with the grace and poise of a hunting larynx. His every move was considered, his every pronouncement precise. Where Castor's eyes were a soft blue approaching grey, the Reavers were like ice, cold and unyielding. His shaved head was crisscrossed with ridges of thick white scar tissue, and Castor could count on one hand the number of times he had encountered him without the skeletal leer of his skull mask fixed in place. His grim demeanour would likely have seen him treated as an outcast by the Brotherhood,
were it not for the fact that there was barely a single member of the Fulminata who did not owe their lives to the intervention of his Reavers at some point or another. No other squad came close to their kill tallies, and even the likes of Lieutenant Samson would have thought twice before coming between them and their designated kill target.
Demeter used to describe them as his hunting hounds. Give them the scent, and they would not stop until their quarry had been tracked down and brought to heel. The Reaver Sergeant's eyes had been fixed unblinkingly on the Thunderhawk's deck, but they rose abruptly, meeting Castor's. The chaplain found himself recalling the cold, predatory gaze of the crophound that had come for the grox herd he'd been watching over one night, the memory dredged abruptly from his youth. He'd known that to break contact with the starved animal would mean instant death, yet the urge had been overwhelming. He'd hesitated, standing his ground, torch in hand, the grox behind him lowing in distress as they caught the predator's scent. He decided later on that the encounter had surely lasted only seconds, and yet it had felt like so much longer, his young heart hammering in his chest, his skinny limbs trembling, breath held, as though to even emit it would be to risk the savagery of claws and fangs. Polixis had saved him that night. The older boy had come running with another torch in hand, shouting at the top of his lungs. The beast had taken fright and loped back off into the darkness. But Polixis wasn't here any more. Severus looked away, turning his eyes to the deck again. Castor realized he'd been holding his breath.
1 hour out, brethren, the voice of the pilot, Quilo, crackled over the intercom.
Castor forced himself to take his eyes off the Reavers and glance at the locator auspecs wired above the hull's disembarkation ramp. It showed their latest fixing, just east of the tombstones and south of Shabbat. Ostensibly the plan was simple. Insertion into the mountains around the city, followed by infiltration into its ruined heart. Whatever purpose Polixis had been taken for, it was almost certain the warlord of the Wah would demand such a potent trophy. Finding Urgork would lead to finding Polixis, and discovering the location of a greenskin leader was rarely a difficult process. That was what he had impressed on Severus when he had caught the Reaver's reticence at allowing the chaplain to join his brethren. The hard part would be living long enough to get Polixis out. Severus had run over the operation with Castor immediately after takeoff. He had spoken only briefly to the chaplain when he had first arrived, jogging through the swirling ash cloud just as the three Reavers were climbing the Thunderhawk's rear ramp.
"If you are to accompany us, brother chaplain, you will follow my directives to the letter," he had said.
Castor had sworn he would do so. No questions about his inclusion were asked. Castor had no doubt the Reaver was aware Tyrannus had not approved his place in the mission. nor, however, had the lieutenant specifically forbade him from going.
There had been neither binding oaths nor orders. Had he been a part of the demi-company's direct command structure, there was no doubt he would have been forced to remain on the ridge, but his position as chaplain afforded him the autonomy he needed. Those were the conclusions he had drawn during the afternoon's meditations. Had Captain Demeter ordered him to stay, he would have stayed. As it stood, though, only the strictest reading of the Codex would have indicated that he had no other option than to follow Lieutenant Tyrannus's directives and remain on the ridge. The letter was clear. The moral was not. Did the Brotherhood still need him, and would a renewed greenskin assault right now push them beyond breaking point? He doubted it. The truth was, he had been at peace the moment he had stepped down from the wreckage of the Orc fighter's fuselage. He was going to find his brother, or he was going to die trying. If there were any consequences, he would face them unflinchingly when he returned.
"You are concerned, brother chaplain," said Severus, over the sound of Dromedus's engines.
Custer realized he was looking at him once more.
"Is that why you so rarely remove your mask, sergeant?" he replied. "So no one can discern your true feelings?"
"The masks are not for our benefit, but for those we hunt," Severus said, humorlessly. "We are their death made manifest. Regardless of whether they fight or flee, we will come for them. They must be made to understand that."
"Two covers of the same book," Castor said, looking down at his own skull helm, locked to his hip. "I am a reminder of mankind's mortality, the revelation that all shall stand before the Emperor and be judged, vengefully, if need be. You bring that same lesson to mankind's enemies."
"We do,"
Severus said, his eyes still on the chaplain. They had conversed before about the particular beliefs of the Reavers and their place within the chapter. Even the hardliners had accepted that the Codex Astartes supported their mode of warfare. Covert infiltration and brutal shock tactics were already at the heart of many Space Marine combat doctrines. It was the Reavers' more unconventional trappings that had caused concern outside their brotherhood. The skull masks and the morbidity, the closed nature of their squads, and the rumours of blood rites and cult-like inductions. Castor knew such stories for what they were, unsound gossip, and was sure to stamp them out wherever and whenever they reared up in the sparring blocks or barrack dorms. Appearances aside, the Reavers were no death cult. Perhaps Castor's respect for their insular aspects was part of the reason Severus hadn't refused him. Or perhaps he understood better than anyone else in the Fulminata the terrible urges that took hold when a brother fell or was captured. Perhaps that was why he hadn't questioned him when he had appeared from the ash with a look as cold as his own in those pale eyes. Polixis slept the half-sleep of the Adeptus Astartes, his thoughts sluggish and distant. The catalepsian node, the sixth of the glands, organs, and nodes that made a space marine, allowed its bearer to enter a meditative state when regular sleep was not an option. Parts of the brain were rested in turn, allowing Polixis to maintain a degree of consciousness and readiness. Without it, he would not have been able to sleep at all. The urge to continue his attempts at escape had only increased as Urgork had left him and darkness had descended on the basilica. It had to have been days since he had last slept, and while a Primaris was more than capable of remaining combat effective for long periods at a time, Polixis understood better than most the importance of rest. The pain of torture and the mental and physical strain of his unique form of imprisonment had worn him down. He was resistant to hardship, but not immune. The cold, clinical part of his mind told him as much, even as the rest of his thoughts continued to burn with anger he was sure his younger brother would have approved of. The mere fact that the Xenos thought it could use him to its own ends was enough of an affront, even before he considered the defilement of the basilica around him. He did not need Castor's battle rites to feel an unaccustomed surge in his hatred for the enemies of mankind whenever he came across their blasphemies against the imperial creed. Perhaps it was simply his brother's nature finally rubbing off on him.
"You taught me more than you know, little brother," he growled.
Eventually, he was able to quell his thoughts and reassert his detachment enough to find a degree of rest. Around him, the basilica had largely fallen silent. It seemed even the greenskins needed time to recover from their near-constant scrapping. Dozens lay sprawled across the bare stone floor, most of them intoxicated by the vile-smelling fungal brew they seemed to imbibe so much of. Even the squig beasts were unconscious, rocking gently on their backs, their warty tongues lolling from open maws, and stubby, upturned limbs twitching the air. Where Urgork had gone, Polixus didn't know. His altar throne was now vacant. The apothecary had last seen the deformed greenskin limping down into the basilica's undercroft, accompanied by his gaggle of flunkies and minions. Presumably the orcs had already discovered the munitions abandoned in the crypts beneath, left behind by the guard during their hasty evacuation. Polixus didn't doubt the shells were already being lobbed back at the artillery pieces they had been forged for all along Ridge One. He could hear the distant rumble of the guns on the heavy night air. In his own absence, Urgork had left the greenskins that had first captured Polixus to guard him through the night, surely as much from their fellow orcs as to stop any escape attempt. The apothecary had encountered their kind before, albeit on only a few occasions. They seemed to style themselves after the covert units of the Astra Militarum and Tempestus Scions, engaged in crude and basic sabotage, assassination, and the penetration of rear-line cohorts. While their raggedy capes and rugged night-vision goggles could appear incongruous, Polixus had witnessed their work firsthand. The ambush in the Carsin Delta on Myra III, and the great hunt through the Solek jungles. They could be extremely deadly. They were a reminder that while Imperial propaganda worked tirelessly to portray the Green Menace as crude, oafish, and savage, such a view was disingenuous. The orcs could not have infested vast swathes of the galaxy with their brutish spore without being highly adaptable and cunning. That was something too many good soldiers of the Imperium, officers and men alike, had discovered to their cost. Polixus realized he too had made the same mistake. He had allowed himself to be drawn into the fury of the breach assault during the battle on the ridge, and had become snared. That the orc commandos appeared to have been sent specifically for him was an even more disturbing revelation. Urgork still hadn't described exactly what he wanted from the Primaris, seemingly content to let the question prey on him during the long, dark hours. While Polixus could conceive of nothing he feared that would break him, either mentally or physically, every moment he remained in captivity created a further moment of risk. What if the Xenos used him to draw in the Fulminata, or tried to bargain with the likes of Field Marshal Kloss? How many men might be lost if he was utilized as bait? What was worse, how would Castor react? He had no doubt his brother believed he was still alive. Had Tyrannus managed to convince him not to embark on a rescue attempt? Would his rage allow him to pause long enough to reflect on the madness of risking his own life in some hopeless effort, now that the chaplain's leadership and guidance was needed by the Fulminata more than ever before? From the sounds of the distant artillery, it seemed as though another offensive was already underway. Were his battle brothers even now fighting against the onrushing green tide, suffering their blows without their apothecary at hand to aid them?
"Guide my blood brother," Polixus muttered,
reaching out once more to the Emperor and the Primarch.
"For the sake of the chapter, don't let him do anything foolish."
The thought of Castor engaged in an effort to save him made Polixus's captivity intolerable. He had to try to get out, but escape was impossible if he was immobilized. As time elapsed, he drifted in and out of his subconscious, allowing his catalepsian node to engage and fade out his bleak surroundings. How long he remained in a fugue state was difficult to tell. With his auto-sensors offline and his helmet gone, He had no access to a chronometer, and the darkness within the basilica remained near complete, lit only by a few red embers amidst the piles of trash and broken pews the orcs had been roasting their food over. At some point, motion disturbed his languished thoughts, triggering a bland impulse that returned him immediately to full consciousness. His guards had drifted off to sleep, but there was one greenskin in the defiled